Our next case is Fryer Reinig versus Reinig. Fryer Reinig versus Reinig.
May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, my name is Angela Lennon, and I am an attorney of record for the appellant, Ms. Pamela Fryer. Your honors, this case is about a couple of things. The first is we'll ask you to look at the clear application of well-defined case law regarding premarital property in a divorce action. The second thing we'll ask you to look at today is a mathematical error made by the district court. And we'll also talk about whether the word equalization means to make equal. As such, we can focus on two main issues. The first is that we're asking that Ms. Fryer be awarded her iHeartMedia 401k as her premarital property. The second was we're asking this court to find that the district court abused its discretion in its mathematical calculation of the property equalization payment. We're asking this court to correct the mathematical error. With regards to the iHeartMedia 401k, we're asking that Ms. Fryer be awarded the entirety of the value of the 401k, approximately $38,262. The testimony at trial was very clear. First, Ms. Fryer did not work at iHeartMedia during the course of the marriage. Second, she did not make any contributions to that account during the marriage. Further, her testimony was that she worked at Cox Communications during the course of the party's marriage. And fourth, the appellee didn't contradict Ms. Fryer's testimony during trial. In fact, the appellee was not even sure or familiar with the iHeartMedia employer whatsoever. When asked at trial, did Ms. Fryer work at iHeartMedia when she was married to you? His response was, I don't know what iHeartMedia was. In addition to that testimony, we have two exhibits. The first exhibit is Exhibit 90. That is a statement from iHeartMedia, a quarterly statement from April to June of 2002, showing the balance of $12,079. I'll remind the court here today that the date of marriage of the parties is May 4th, 2002. Now, there was some confusion at trial as to the exact date of marriage when the parties were on the witness stands. I think the nerves might have got the best of them because the appellant said they were married in 2004, and the appellee said maybe it was 2002 or 2004. But I'll point the court to the record of the complaint, the answer, and the answer and counterclaim, all of which affirm the actual date of marriage is May 4th, 2002. So we have a statement dated directly around the date of marriage that said the value of the account was $12,000 at the time of marriage. Then we have Exhibit 64, which is a statement as of November of 2016, shortly after the parties separated, that said the balance of the iHeartMedia 401k account was $38,262.
Let me interrupt you for 1 second. Was there any testimony as to how it got there? Is there any testimony in the record as it relates to, all right, it was $12,000 at the time of the marriage. I understand your position here with respect to this was her 401k she established prior to the marriage. But to go from 12 to 38, it grew. Is there any testimony as to how or why it grew, if it had anything to do with her efforts, anything along those lines?
Sure, Your Honor. The testimony is that she didn't make any contributions to the account. So the inference is that the account grew due to natural market forces, which is exactly where I wanted to go next. And I want to point you to the Stevens v. Stevens case that the Supreme Court decided 2 years ago that talked about what do you do with the growth of a non-marital account that grows during the course of the marriage that's not due to direct contributions of either of the parties. So in Stevens v. Stevens, the court defines for us what is passive appreciation. And they say, you have a non-marital account that grows during the course of the marriage, as long as you can show that the growth was not due to, you can directly contribute the growth to the non-marital portion of the account, and it wasn't due to any direct contribution by the parties. Rather, the growth was passive, such as inflation or direct market growth, that's called passive appreciation, and you can set that off to the person who owned the account prior to marriage.
Was there any testimony as to whether she had made any changes in investments in that?
No, there was no testimony into that regard. We believe that the fact that we have the account statements from the date of marriage, the testimony that she didn't make any contributions into that account, and there's nothing in the record of the appellee rebutting any of the testimony or evidence submitted by the appellant, that she met her burden of proof to show that the growth of the account and the account itself should be set off to her as her premarital property. At a minimum, however, the district court abused its discretion by not awarding her the value of the account as of May 4th of 2002. We have an account that says it was worth $12,000. The court didn't even do that. It just ignored the evidence submitted to the court with regard to that account. The second issue I want to talk about today is the property equalization payment. So the district court made a mathematical error when it was attempting to equalize the division of property between the parties. In the decree on page 12, the court sets forth a summary of the assets that are awarded to each of the parties. And the result was, after the court decided who would receive which asset, that Ms. Fryer was awarded $186,317 more in assets than the appellee. After the court set forth that summary, the court specifically stated that it was his intention to equalize the marital estate. Page 12 reads, "To equalize the discrepancy, the plaintiff shall pay to the defendant a property equalization payment of $186,317. So what we have here is we have the court acknowledging there was a discrepancy in the division of the marital estate. The court's trying to remedy that discrepancy by saying we are going to equalize the estate and here's how we're going to do so. Unfortunately, the result of his mathematical equation doesn't reach the end result. Now what we have is my client has to pay to the appellee $186,317. The result is now the appellee has $186,317 and more in assets, which was not the court's stated intention.
Can you make an equalization? Can a court require an equalization payment yet still just do an equitable distribution?
I suppose the court could. There were no cases cited in the record by the appellee that shows the court that that's what the district court intended. In this case, if the court would have, I believe the court would have made specific findings about why it would have swung from Ms. Fryer having $186,000 more in assets as opposed to now Mr. Fryer should have $186,000 more in assets. I'll point you to the Ward v. Ward case. In that case, the district court made an unequal distribution of the estate, and the higher court found that there were no findings by the district court to justify an unequal distribution. So like in that case, in this case, there are no findings that there's a reason why one party should be awarded more assets over the other. In fact, the court tells us we have a discrepancy and he's trying to equalize it. Additionally, I do want to acknowledge some of the case law that was discussed by the appellee, especially in the DeBlisco case. It talks about that there's case law that the division of the marital estate is not subject to a precise mathematical formula. And we acknowledge that. However, our case is differentiated because Judge Thompson specifically on page 12 gives you a mathematical formula that he's trying to use to equalize the estate. It was just an error.
He was trying to do a 50-50 division.
He was, right? And he just didn't quite get there. And I don't blame him, but we're here to fix it today. In that Jalisco case, the husband received 47% of the estate. The wife received 53% of the estate. And the appellee will tell you that those are the same exact percentages were off here in terms of the percentage of estate that the court awarded to the parties in this case. However, in that case, that court did not order a property equalization payment. The court just ordered each party should be awarded different assets. So the court didn't even attempt to equalize the estate in that case. Additionally, in his brief, Mr. Raining argues that the word equalize does not mean to make equal. He suggests that there's simply not another word in the English language that would be appropriate or relevant to describe how we allocate assets between the parties. However, I'll point this court's to section 42-365, which reads, the purpose of a property division is to divide a marital estate is to divide it equitably between the parties. If the court intended to do an equitable division, that's what the court would have done and that's what the court would have said. The court would have just left it as Ms. Fryer receiving 186 grand more in assets if the court wanted it to be equitable. But that was not the stated intention of the court. He found there was a discrepancy. He attempted to remedy it, and we're asking the court to fix that mathematical error, subject to a couple of other issues. The first, I'll just point you to a non-proton that was entered on January 11th of 2019. The court found it miscalculated the total value of the vehicles awarded to the appellee by $1,000. So he acknowledges that in the non-proton, but then he doesn't go back and add it as the total number of assets on page 12 or alter the property equalization payment by $1,000. Second, we're asking you to set off the iHeartMedia 401k to Ms. Fryer as her sole and separate property before you attempt to recalculate the property equalization payment. We find that to be an abuse of discretion. We're asking that this court agree. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can I approach?
You may.
Good afternoon. I'm Matthew Higgins. May it please the court. I represent Mr. Jerry Raining, the defendant appellee here today, and we're resisting the request being made of the court. The first item I'd like the court to address is this business of the equalization payment. Now, if I was solely relying on the fact that the Apple Online Dictionary defines equal as meeting a standard or coming up to a particular level, I would think maybe perhaps my argument would be a bit thin. But I'd like the court to note that the court, Judge Thompson, did review all of his mathematics again. At the motion for a new trial, he reviewed the materials, discovered an error that he thought he spotted. He was off by $1,000, and he made the adjustment. So the idea that it's a mistake seems quite unlikely. I know the numbers.
Was that issue raised with the court?
Yes. If you take a look, I believe both the motion and the order are part of the record. That was raised, that the balance of the money was not correct. In other words, the way the property equalization, the way they thought it should have looked, was to actually make it equal. I don't think he intended to do that. And the reason I don't think he intended to do that is his honor took another look at it and doubled down and said, no, that's what I intended.
But he didn't do the $1,000 ride on the car either, though.
Yes, Your Honor, but one slight difference there is we simply conceded the point. We simply said, we don't want to argue about this $1,000 issue, don't want to have to brief this on an appeal, we're just going to walk away from it. And so there really wasn't a consideration of the court of that particular item. We just stipulated. So that's what I have to say about the equalization. The other thing is...
Wait, you're saying you stipulated that there should be another $1,000 in there?
Yeah, that there was an error.
But even when he, in the non-proton, when he added in that $1,000, didn't he still make an error because he didn't change the bottom number?
Your Honor, I can't say for sure one way or the other. Neither myself or opposing counsel asked for specific findings of fact. I suppose if we use that $1,000 transfer to define the logic of his decision in this regard, yeah, you would be correct. We're looking at another error. But he did review his math, and if he can spot a $1,000 mistake, chances are he would have spotted a $183,000 mistake. So the idea that it's the mistake of the judge in mathematics seems improbable, him having both been briefed by both counsel, listening to 3 days of evidence. We then briefed it after the fact. We went back for a motion for a new trial, and upon reviewing the materials now multiple times, he sticks with the figure. So if it's anything, it's not a math error or a mistake on the part of Judge Thompson. If there's some other way that it's unfair, I don't see it in the record. And I'll tell the court something that was on everybody's mind. It's in our briefs. The court has upheld property divisions as Titus 36-64. I point the court to the Finley-Swanson decision. Now, regarding the other item that was argued, the iHeartMedia account, it is... You've noticed by your review of the other records and other cases that it is usually the practice of the trial courts to require some evidence of whether or not monies are contributed to retirement accounts, regardless of when they are accumulated. So for an account that supposedly ended before or after the marriage, we now have one statement 14 years later that says it now has a new value. I mean, it would have been nothing to get the other year-end accounts from the investment company. and show, well, take a look at this. No manipulations were made to the account. I think that burden's on them.
Does our case law require documentary evidence? Because don't we have the testimony that she didn't make any contributions?
We do, but I would also ask the court to view that with suspicion. Why on earth, if you could prove every single year, would you not do that?
How could she make contributions to her 401k if she wasn't employed there?
Well, I can say she probably couldn't, but I'll point out to the court that Mr. Raining said he didn't know when she stopped working there. If you take a look at his exact answers in the record as to when he thought she was working there, I guess what I'm saying is we don't believe she's telling the truth about all that.
Wasn't his testimony, I don't know what it is?
Yeah, his testimony was she worked for a number of media companies. I don't know which one. He knows that she worked for at least one of the media companies. So
he's not contradicting her. He says, I'm not sure.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
He's not contradicting her testimony. He's saying, I'm not sure. Her testimony is, I worked at iHeart prior to our marriage. I never made a contribution thereafter. He says, I don't know.
I'll concede that point. Would the court like me to address any of the other particular errors? Because what I have to say about those are in the brief, but I'd be happy.
Let's talk about the $30,000 in dissipation and assets, please.
Yes. Again, there's nothing in the record to suggest why the court did that. We didn't ask for some specific findings. My assumption, and one I'd like the court to adopt, is that they just viewed it as his income. His testimony was that he essentially owned some rental properties where he collected rents and he was the landlord and repairman, and that his other secondary type of job was to buy and sell old vehicles and things he buys at swap meets, improve them, and sell them for a profit. There was nothing in the record that contradicted that that wasn't what he was doing, and that, we think, the judge simply judged as his income.
But those autos that he was selling, those were marital property, right? There's no indication in this record that that's anything other than marital property, correct?
That's correct.
So if he took the $30,000, which is marital property, and he distributes it to his biological daughter, how is that not a dissipation of assets?
Well, the way I reason this is that these were items that he purchased, and so the purchase price of these items that he admitted in his testimony was de minimis. These were not expensive items, and so an argument could be made that the initial investment in these items would be marital property. But if this is his job, this is his income. And I'd like the court to note that despite the great disparity in income, depending on what other records you were willing to accept, Mr. Raining's income is anywhere from $25,000 to $50,000. Ms. Raining's, with her bonus, is in the $175,000 range. We have quite a long marriage. My assumption is that he has ascribed that income to Mr. Raining and his decision not to award any alimony. I simply thought he thought it was Mr. Raining's income. Not that there was $30,000. In other words, it wasn't as if there was $30,000 worth of property that they had had for a while, then he sold for $30,000. He had purchased this property at a much, much lower value, improved it, sold it, and that's how he earns his income. That was his income.
During the marriage?
I think this is right around the time that they had filed. The record for the testimony of the parties is unclear whether it was the week before, the week of, the week after, when this money was transferred.
But the work would have had to have been done during the marriage.
Yes, Your Honor.
So how would that be different? Even if it is his work, if you get paid for your work after you've separated, but the work is done during the marriage, isn't that your marital estate?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say if there was some evidence that all this work done was, say, done 2 years prior, I don't have an argument, but there is no evidence. What there is evidence of is in the months prior to the divorce even being filed, Ms. Raining swore out a protection order against Mr. Raining and had him excluded from the residence. And I think it's just that means she wanted him in jail. She wanted the court to have a protection order on him. That, to me, the marriage is irretrievably broken. Right then and there, the marriage is broken. This money was disposed of well after that.
Any
Are there any other items? There's a minute 10, and I was not going to reserve any time to do anything.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time is remaining for the appellant?
None, Your Honor.
None. Okay. Case is submitted. Counsel is excused. Thank you.